Hey, good morning, everybody. Bio 231, Human Anatomy, and it is Wednesday, 4th of March. All right, I'm going to turn some of these lights down and get going. I like that one off, those off, maybe even that one off. Okay, let's look at the schedule on the right-hand side. So we said today is the 4th. Good, that's on your schedule. I'm right. We're going to get into skeletal muscle tissue today, the introductory chapter. We'll look and see why muscle is special in that it can shorten or contract. We have to finish up just a couple things on joints, and then we'll move into skeletal muscle. So when is your next practicum or your exam? So it is 1 week, 1.5 weeks away for your lecture exam, and it's going to be on a Monday, the 16th, and it's going to cover 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. So we're going to get into 10 today, and then next week we're just going to finish up some things in Chapter 11, actually look at some muscles. All right, so that's what's on the next test. And then your practicum is the week after that, not until the week after. That would be practicum number 2. And then you know where you're going to be in the class after that? You'll be half done with the class after that week. Amazing. All right, so that means that the week after that spring break, you can go out and celebrate quite a bit, all right? And I'll celebrate with you. So here is the sign-in sheet. Make sure you sign sign-in sheet. It's the last column. I didn't label the last column, but if you want to put March 4th on there, you're welcome to do that. Okay, anybody have any questions on the lecture schedule or lab schedule, anything about the schedule? Yeah, hi. Well, for the lecture exam, 7 through 11, and on the practicum, it's going to be lab unit number 2. And I can't remember what labs are involved with lab unit number 2. So it's it's probably 4, 5, 6, and 7, something like that. It's either 4, 5, 6, or 4, 5, 6, 7, because 1, 2, 3 were on the first practicum. But whatever contained in lab unit number 2, it's kind of easy to see that when you open up the lab manual. Okay, that sort of answer your question, kind of? Okay, really good. All right, any questions on joints? What's another name for joint? Articulation. What is an articulation? Why are we talking? It's a whole chapter. That's where two bones join together, right? And so a joint is just where bones come very close together, joined together, and of course some joints are freely movable, like your elbow for instance. Other joints are not freely movable, like sutures, and then there are some that are kind of like in between. And how would you classify, what are the three classifications by mobility that a joint can have? We want to take a joint, put it in, name it. Yeah, said you got... Oh, I don't even have it on the slide right here. We got synarthrosis, amphiarthrosis, diarthrosis. Which one is the most movable? Diarthrosis, right. And there's one kind of joint by structure that is always going to be a diarthrosis, meaning freely movable. Right. So a lot of different joints by structures don't always fit into one category, but there's one by structure that always fits into the diarthrosis category, and that is the synovial joint, right? And so that kind of leads me into telling you how important that synovial joint is. That's an important exam figure because it has a bunch of pieces to it, right? Over the ends of bones, you have articular cartilage. Between the articular cartilages, you got a fluid called synovial fluid. That synovial fluid comes from the synovial membrane, which is the deepest part of the joint capsule. Okay, and what is just superficial to the synovial membrane? It is a fibrous capsule. And then so fibrous capsule, synovial membrane make the joint capsule together. And then sometimes you have ligaments that span across a joint. Sometimes you have a tendon that goes across a joint, spans the joint. And what else did we learn about? Something, yeah, bursa. And tendon sheaths, they're sort of like a synovial joint, right? But they're like a little pillow between structures that will bang up against each other, like a muscle and a bone or a tendon and a bone. Because when muscles contract, sometimes they contract very rigorously and just pound up against something. All right, so that's pretty much what we talked about last time. Oh, except for some motions. Here are some motions you see on the left-hand slide. I'm going to put the schedule away. Right, put schedule away like that. Here are a bunch of motions. I think we covered all these motions. Almost. Not quite. Oh, I see one we didn't cover. Okay. And I see dorsiflexion and plantar flexion. We didn't talk about that one. Was there another one we didn't talk about? G? Oh, shapes. Yeah, we're going to talk about shapes for sure. Yeah, we'll finish up by talking about shapes. But as far as special movements in the body, we didn't talk about dorsiflexion and plantar flexion. Okay. Well, let's just review a couple of things just so I can get it straight in my mind. Let's look at my elbow. Okay, my elbow isn't moving, so you can't say anything that's happening. But now let me contract my biceps. What's happening at the elbow?
Flexion.
Yeah, because that angle is decreasing. Triceps contracts, then this is extension. Elbow cannot hyperextend, right? Your wrist can hyperextend. So let's think about the wrist. This is flexion of the wrist. Here is extension, hyperextension. That's really nice. Okay, so at the wrist, once again, this is flexion, and here is extension. All right, so now I want to go jump from your hand to your foot. All right, and your foot is a little strange because if we go in anatomic position, when we flex at the elbow, right, my hand comes anteriorly and is elevated. Right, but if I flex at the knee, what happens? Does my leg move anteriorly?
No,
it goes the other way. It goes posteriorly. Right, so there's some funny rotation, rearrangement of the lower appendage compared to the upper. So when we look at the ankle, we got some special motions to take a look at. Flexion and extension at the wrist are easy to tell, but at the ankle, we come up with some different terminology. All right, so I'm gonna work my ankle, and I'm going to try to push my toes into the ground. If I push my toes into the ground, that lifts my whole body up. Okay, we call that plantar flexion. Right, when you push your toes into the ground, plantar flexion. When I plantar flex, okay, that just raises my whole body up. And the opposite motion to that is when I raise my toes off the ground. Okay, that's what we call dorsiflexion. So we don't have flexion and extension at the ankle. We have two types of flexion. One is plantar, the other is dorsiflexion. Dorsiflexion is when you lift your toes up off the ground. So that was maybe a little bit too complicated. I see it right here. All right, so plantar flexion, when you bend at the ankle so that the anterior part of your foot goes down. Dorsi is when you lift your toes up. Well, you know, during the time when physicians actually had time to see patients, okay, they would be in their room working, and a patient would walk in the room and sit down and talk to them. And as a patient was walking into a room, almost 9 times out of 10, a doctor would diagnose what's happening with the patient just by the way they were saying hi, how they were moving, how they sat down, okay, by their overall look. And today that really doesn't happen, okay. But watching a patient walk, all right, is important. So today, patients are in the room already, waiting for the doctor, and probably waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting, right? All right, but so a doctor will still do one thing, all right? When he walks into the room or she walks into the room, they will look at the bottoms of a patient's shoes, especially at the tip, near the toes, all right? So why could that be important? Well, if somebody cannot dorsiflex, right, dorsiflex, lifting their toes up off the ground, if they can't dorsiflex, what's going to happen to their shoes when they walk? They're going to drag along the ground, right, because they can't lift their toes up off the ground. And I don't know, what would be some of the consequences of that if somebody's, like, dragging the tip of their shoes on the ground like that? Yeah, tripping and falling. I better check. No, mine are good. Okay, well, tripping on a crack in the sidewalk for us is probably not such a big deal, right, because we still have a good equilibrium sense. We'll catch ourselves before we fall over. But an elderly person has a large chance of falling down. And as we get older, what happens to our bones?
They get brittle,
right, because of osteoporosis. especially women, but it happens to men as well. And if you're in that age group and you fall down, there is one kind of fracture that's very common, and that is a hip fracture. Okay? And when you're in that age population and break a hip, you can't recuperate at home. You have to go usually to a convalescence center. You can't stay in the hospital anymore, but you can't go home because you need a little bit more attention. And when people, like your grandma and grandpa, when they go to a weird building like that, right, they're away from their family and their normal surroundings, a lot of times they just kind of give up on life as a result of that. I don't know if anybody's ever noticed that. Okay, so elderly people are really sensitive to having family and familiar surroundings around them all the time. And so that's an important observation, because if you can see somebody's having problems dorsiflexing, right, if we follow that logically through all the way, you can actually, what, save somebody's life, which is pretty amazing. So when somebody has trouble dorsiflexing, the problem might not be in the muscles of the leg, but could be due to a spinal cord injury or something to do with the vertebral column when somebody has problems dorsiflexing. And when we get into the nervous system, you'll see why that is. All right, so pay pretty close attention to all these different kinds of motions, because we're going to learn some muscles, but more importantly, right, you can come up with some really nice, easy diagnoses to help patients just by watching them move, right, if they can dorsiflex or not, for instance. Okay, so what else do we want to talk about in terms of motions of the body? I think we covered everything. One thing I just want to remind you of is most of these motions are, you see right here, are in antagonistic pairs. Like, could anybody give me an example of two motions that are antagonistic to each other? Abduction and adduction, sure. Okay, when I raise my arms up to the level of my shoulders, that is abduction. When I bring them back down to my thigh, that is adduction. Those are antagonistic motions. They have two different kinds of muscles. And because there's antagonistic control, what can you say about the position, or what can I understand about the position of my arm? Okay, because it's control with these two mechanisms that are antagonistic to each other, right? You have precise control and balance of where your arm is going. Right, so antagonism is a really important concept in anatomy, and even more so physiology, because if you understand antagonism and the structures that are antagonistic to each other in the body, you know exactly how your body is controlled, how it functions in a very precise way and a balanced way. Okay, another good example might be, for instance, in terms of the muscle system, the biceps and triceps work against each other. So you might think that's kind of futile, but when you have antagonistic control systems, then you have what? Precise control and balance of where your hand is going, for instance. All right. You will learn eventually nervous system is based on that principle of antagonism. Hormonal regulation is built on that principle of antagonism. That's going to be really important. Okay. Last thing in this chapter that we have to talk about are shapes of joints. Depending on the shape of the joint, right, or if the shape of a joint changes, what happens to, what else can you tell me about a joint? Yeah, function changes, right? So the shape of a joint determines what kind of motion it can undergo. Okay, so here are a couple types of shapes of joints. Here is a plain joint that we see between tarsals and carpals, right? So these are just flat bones, and you can see that there is no rotation, there is just sliding between these two bones. Right? So we call this a transitional, but there's no bending associated with it. And we see these kinds of joints between carpals and tarsals in the ankle. Right? So this kind of joint doesn't allow for flexion or extension or rotation, abduction, adduction, nothing like that. Right, but just a slight bit of sliding of one bone on top of the other. All right, so that's a plain joint. Right, then there are some other kinds of joints that do allow for angular motion and maybe rotation. Here is a really good example of one of the next most complex kind of joint, and this is a hinge joint. And a hinge joint, you could think of a hinge on a cabinet or a door to this room, for instance. And a hinge joint allows only for two motions that are antagonistic to each other. For instance, like flexion and extension, right? But not flexion and extension and at the same time adduction and abduction, right? It's just one or the other. So here's a nice elbow joint. And I see a humerus, I see ulna, and I see this notch right here in the ulna, and that articulates with what part on the humerus? Yeah, you should have that on the tip of your tongue pretty soon. Here's the trochlea, that's a condylar surface, right, on that distal epiphysis of the humerus. And the trochlea associates with what part of the ulna? The trochlear notch, right, the trochlear notch. So again, when we have a feature on a bone, we don't name that feature by the bone that it's on, but by the feature that it is associated with, right? So here's the trochlear notch because, not because it's on the ulna, but because it articulates with the trochlea that's on the humerus, right? So it matches up really nice. So this is just a pure hinge joint for flexion and extension of the elbow. Happens between the humerus and the ulna. And sometimes we call that a uniaxial movement or motion because it's just flexion and extension. Okay, hinge. A pivot joint. Right? Here we see a pivot joint and I can see an ulna, right, and a radius. And here's the head of the radius. And here's a nice annular ligament that holds the head of the radius up against the ulna. So these are both on the proximal epiphyses. And notice that there is a depression, right, in the ulna. What would we want to call that depression? Just for fun, because you're going to have to know that in lab or something like that. It's on the ulna. Do we want to name it the ulnar notch or the ulnar groove or the ulnar fossa? No, because it's on the ulna. We want to name it by the bone that joins right there, and that is the radius, right? So this depression right here is called the radial notch, right? So it's a nice depression. The head of the radius fits in there, and you can see that the head of the radius is nice and circular, and so that allows for a rotation of the radius up against the ulna in this location. So this is a pivot joint. This joint cannot flex, cannot extend, right? But it can medial rotate or lateral rotate, or maybe a better way of talking about that is let's look and see what happens. All right, so I'm in anatomic position right now. I'm going to rotate the head of my radius and the radial notch of the ulna, and look what happens. What is that motion called? I think we talked about that. I hope we did. Yeah, so anatomic position, my palms are facing anteriorly, but when that rotation or pivot takes place, right, that is called pronation. Right, when I have my palms face anteriorly, that is supination. I might have misspoke for a second right there. Right, palms facing anteriorly, that is a supinated position, right, because if you bring your hands together, it can form a bowl, like a soup bowl, supination. Right, when the palms face posteriorly, right, that is a pronated position, or going from supinated to pronate, we call that pronation motion. And in order for that to happen, the radius and ulna have to cross over each other, and this rotation takes place between the head of the radius and the radial notch in the ulna. All right, so that's a special joint, that's a special motion at the elbow that the knee cannot do. Right? The knee can't rotate like that. All right, so that is also a uniaxial kind of motion. There are some joints that are a little bit more complicated. Here's one that just looks like a dome, and it fits into a very shallow socket. Right? We're going to call this a condyloid joint, like between the bones in your hand. Ooh, what are these bones in your hand called? Yeah, the metacarpals, right? Carpals are wrist, metacarpals are hand. So between a metacarpal and the proximal phalanx, there's kind of a special joint, right? Because you can spread your fingers out. Let's call that abduction. You can bring your fingertips together. We can call that adduction. And what else can you do with that joint? You can flex and extend, maybe hyperextend a little bit. All right, so this is what we call a biaxial movement, right, because of that abduction, flexion, and extension. And this is allowed with this kind of condyloid joint, right? So this is a biaxial movement. So here you have a medial lateral axis, but there's also anterior posterior axis. And so for flexion extension, think of the rotation around this medial lateral axis. Right? If it is for adduction and abduction, then the axis is going to be oriented in the anterior posterior direction. But always think of anatomic position. All right, so that is kind of a handy joint because it gives you a much more range of motion. All right, another kind of joint, which is very similar, right, is called a saddle joint. And a saddle joint is between this metacarpal. Now, what metacarpal is this one right here? Number one. So this is your thumb, right? And so here's a joint between a carpal, a trapezium. Oh, you don't have to know that, but here is a carpal. You should know this is a carpal, right? And then here is number one, metacarpal. That's a special joint called a saddle joint. And this is also allows for biaxial motion. What does it allow? It allows for adduction, abduction, I guess, right? Let's do that. Here I am abducting, right? Here is adduction, just like that, right? But we can also flex and extend at that joint. So here is flexion, right? And here is extension, right? And when you put all those motions together, we get a motion called opposition. Right? So that biaxial joint or the saddle joint, works nicely for these two ways of moving at that joint, and they can be combined together. So this kind of joint kind of looks like a universal joint that's used in mechanical engineering very regularly because it's a very strong joint as opposed to the previous one that we looked at, this condyloid joint, right, is not a very strong joint. But that saddle joint, right, is a very strong kind of joint. Okay, that allows for opposition. Okay, a ball and socket joint kind of looks like a condyloid, right? But the head of the bone is going to be much more spherical. The depression on the corresponding bone is going to be deeper, and there are only two kinds of ball and socket joints, and that is the shoulder and the hip, right? So the head of the humerus is nice and spherical. That associates with the glenoid fossa. Glenoid fossa is not very deep, but it has some special fibrocartilage around the lip of the glenoid fossa that increases the depth of the glenoid fossa. Can anybody remember what that ring of fibrocartilage was called around the glenoid fossa? I had trouble remembering, so I'm sure I can remember, thank goodness. Otherwise, I wouldn't ask you. It's called the labrum, glenoid labrum. Right, glenoid labrum, which it's not shown on this illustration. All right, so at this shoulder joint, okay, what can we do? All right, here's a really tough test. This is a tough test. What motion am I going to do right now at the shoulder? Forget about everything else that's happening in my body, but what is this motion? Okay, what you should be seeing, but it's impossible to see, is a decrease in an angle between two bones. What do you call a decrease in angle between two bones? Flexion. Okay. So here is flexion at the shoulder. Here is extension. Here is hyperextension. All right. Now, how are you going to remember that? Right. Always think of the hip when you're looking at the shoulder. And I'll move my hip and shoulder at the same time. So what is this at the hip? Flexion. All right. So what is this at the shoulder? Flexion. Right. So it kind of mirrors what I'm doing at my hip. Right, so if I'm flexing at the hip and I go through the same kind of motion at the shoulder, that is flexion. Here is extension and hyperextension. What else can you do at the shoulder? Well, you can abduct, right? Flex, extend, abduct, adduct, and you can also rotate at the shoulder. Right, and a good way to, I'm rotating my shoulder right now, it's kind of hard to see, but if you flex at the elbow, so your hand comes up and anterior like that, if I rotate at the shoulder, then it's easy to see that my humerus is rotating. Nothing else is moving, right? My hand is kind of moving through space, but there's because of rotation at the shoulder. So if we add all those motions together, what can you do, and the hip is the same way, what can you do with a ball and socket joint at the shoulder and at the hip? If you combine all those motions at the same time, you call that circumduction. right? So ball and socket joints are the only kind of joint that allow for circumduction. Okay, if you circumduct at the knee or you circumduct, right, at the elbow, that's going to break those joints and ligaments, right, because it just wasn't designed to undergo that kind of motion. Yeah. Is there a question?
No, yeah, question. From the lower joint, you can do circumduction.
You know, I would say no, because you can't rotate. Yeah, but it looks like a circle, but you just can't rotate. I guess because you just don't have the muscles that allow for that kind of motion. No, rotation would be like this. Okay. So this is just a combination flexion, extension, adduction, and abduction. Okay, so it's really just a biaxial motion. So rotation would be if you could actually just take this finger and rotate it without flexing, extending, abducting, or adducting. It just won't be able to do that, right? Even the joint in your thumb, you can't do that. It's only with the hip, right? So how can I rotate at the hip? Like this or like that? Rotate at the shoulder? Like this or like that? Uh-oh. Maybe you have a special joint right there. Wow, I can't do that.
Okay.
Okay, say that again.
You
know, students ask me that all the time, and I always forget to Google it. I'm not sure. I don't think you have like a double anything. It's just that the ligaments are probably not as tight, and the muscular associations, like with a tendon, are a little bit looser, and maybe you can relax certain muscles a little bit more compared to other people, just to loosen the joint up. Yeah. So you're stretching ligaments and tendons out. There's some people have an easier ability to do that, but there's not like a special structure within the joint capsule that allows for that to happen. The same kind of structure, just a little bit looser. Yeah. Okay. At the shoulder, just think of the humerus, all right? But let's flex at the elbow, okay? And then think of the humerus. I can move my hand medially like that. I'm not bending my elbow anymore. The only thing I'm doing is rotating the humerus, okay? And so now I'm rotating the humerus laterally, okay? And if I medial rotate, there's medial rotation. Okay, so that is rotation. Circumduction is this whole thing. What do we have? We got extension, flexion, rotation, and everything all together. Okay. All right, so we said this was flexion. Okay, flexion. And when you're doing a chin-up at the shoulder, okay, what is that motion? At the shoulder, when you're like trying to do a chin up, okay. So here is extension. That is the same kind of thing. Flexion at the elbow, but that is extension at the shoulder. Okay. Okay. Any other questions regarding these joints? Yeah. So circumduction is all of these three motions put together. And the important joints that you should know, of course, are the knee joint. Right? You should know the fine details of the knee, and that's in your lab manual as well. All right, so we can put this away. This is nice because now I can use that terminology, for instance, like flexion, extension, rotation, talking about anatomy without being able to use those terms because I didn't introduce what the meaning was to them is difficult. But now we can really start talking some anatomy, which is nice. Okay, so we're going to look at another kind of tissue, not a connective tissue, but muscle tissue. What is muscle tissue specialized to do? To contract, right? And when a muscle contracts, that's going to move something. Right, so that's one of the main reasons why we have muscle for motility, but it can only contract. It can't expand. It can't push on anything. So what are some functions of muscle tissue? Movement, because when a muscle contracts, opposite ends of the muscle are attached to two different structures in the body, and when that muscle contracts, it brings those two different structures together. And so that produces movement. And if the structures are a part of your skeletal system, then that helps move your skeleton around. Muscle is also important for maintenance of posture. Right, so even if you're not moving, even if you're just sitting still, it requires muscles to keep your body in just a certain position. Because what would happen to you if all the muscles in your body relaxed? Yeah, you just go kaplunk right on the floor. Right, so even though you're not moving, you're still contracting a lot of muscles just to maintain posture. And when you maintain posture, something else happens. Right, it stabilizes joints. So muscle is important for stabilizing joints. And what that means is that muscle prevents joints from moving in a way that is not designed to move. Right? So joint stabilization will require muscles to make sure that the elbow joint doesn't abduct or adduct or rotate. Okay? Because it's not designed to do that. So joint stabilization is an important function of skeletal muscle. And then the other thing is, I think this is pretty easy to appreciate, if you start contracting muscle, like we all started running up and down the stairs over here using our leg muscles, what would happen to our body temperature? It would increase. And you know it increases because what would happen to you? You would start sweating, right? So muscle is good for maintaining body heat. And so if you get cold, what do skeletal muscles do? They're told to... contract. They're told to shiver to increase your body temperature, to maintain your body temperature. So these are the functions of skeletal muscle: movement, posture maintenance, joint stabilization, and heat, generation of heat. Okay, there are some special properties of muscle, right? And this is one that we've talked about so far, and that is muscle can contract. That's an important function, but there are three others that are important to appreciate as well, right? Another special attribute is that muscles are excitable, which means that they can be contracted in one part of time, they can shorten, or they can relax and elongate. Right? So, and in skeletal muscle, you have the voluntary ability to either contract or relax a muscle. Not so much for the heart and smooth muscle. But nonetheless, heart and smooth muscle are still excitable. Right? What about a bone? Is bone excitable? No, it's just kind of sitting there. It's living tissue, but it's just kind of sitting there. There's really not much you can do with a bone, voluntarily or involuntarily. All right, extensibility. That means a muscle can stretch, right? Sort of like elastic tissue, sort of in a sense, right? And how is a really good way to think of that? Well, let's talk about flexion and extension at the elbow. All right, let's flex at the elbow. There's a muscle that has to shorten on the anterior part of your arm that's called the biceps. Right. In order for the biceps to shorten, the muscle on the opposite side of the arm has to stretch. Okay, and that's called the triceps. When the triceps contracts, the muscle on the opposite side of the arm has to stretch. Right. So muscles do have to be able to be stretched. We call that extensibility. Right. And another property that they have is elasticity. If you stretch a muscle, it has the ability to go back to its normal resting length just because of the passive elastic properties of muscle. All right, so there are four important attributes. Three kinds of skeletal muscle, you know what they are, right? Which one of these is under voluntary control? Voluntary control. Skeletal is one. And is that it? Yes, that is it, right? Skeletal muscle is the only one under voluntary control. So cardiac and smooth are involuntarily controlled with regulated by hormones in some cases, and other than that by a part of your nervous system that you do not have conscious control over, and that's called the autonomic nervous system. And as a matter of fact, that autonomic nervous system is built on the principle of antagonism. You have two major divisions of the autonomic nervous system. Usually one is excitatory and the other is inhibitory. All right, they work against each other, but that provides for precise control and balance of various kinds of organs in your body, like your heart, for instance. Okay, but that's all we're going to talk about nervous system for right now. Okay, so skeletal muscle. Let's look and see something about some anatomy of skeletal muscle. All right, so here's some skeletal muscle. Here's biceps that I was talking about. Here's triceps. All right, and here is what a biceps looks like. All right, so think about this biceps right here. This is a muscle. So I want to talk about a whole muscle. And I see one right here. And we have a muscle connected to this bone. Well, here's the femur, so it's not a biceps. It's in your thigh someplace. So here is the muscle. It's attached to a bone via a tendon. Yeah, so a muscle-to-bone connection is a tendon. You know what this tissue looks like underneath the microscope. You know what it's called. So I tell you what, just tell me what kind of tissue is that tendon? What kind of tissue is that? I know you guys know. It's dense, what? Dense, regular connective tissue, right. And it's got certain cells in there called fibroblasts that secrete what kind of chemical into the matrix? Collagen, right? Collagen is a very strong kind of fiber. It doesn't stretch. It's very, very strong. Okay, so there's that connective tissue. That connective tissue is continuous with some other connective tissues that surround the whole muscle. And we call that the epimysium. That epimysium also has collagen fibers, right? And just kind of the overall package for that muscle. And if you look underneath the epimysium, epi just means on top, like epidermis. That might be a good way to think of it. And anytime you hear this word mesium, you should think of muscle. Yeah, that's muscle. Right? And when you look underneath the epimysium at a cross-section of the whole muscle, do you see any structure? Or is it all just like one color? Is it all homogeneous? Do you see any structure? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see structures there. Right, so let me circle one. Here is a structure that I see. Okay, and that's what we call a fascicle. All right, so what do you have to put together to build a muscle? You have to put fascicles together. So fascicles are the building block of a muscle. And let's pull one of these fascicles out. So here I see a fascicle. And if we look inside of a fascicle, does it look homogeneous or do you see structure inside of a fascicle? Again, I see some structure. All right, so let me circle one of these structures. Right, and it's been pulled out, and it's tubular in shape, and it's really, really long. Right, so that thing right there is what we call a muscle cell or a muscle fiber because they're long and narrow, kind of looks like a fiber. All right, so what's another name for a skeletal muscle cell? It's a fiber, and people just call it a fiber all the time, and you should appreciate that that is just a muscle cell. It's a fiber because it's very long and narrow. And if we look inside that muscle fiber, do you see structure? Or is it all just homogeneously colored? Structure. I see structures, right. These structures in here, inside of a muscle cell, are organelles for contraction. And they're called myofibrils. Ah, too bad they're not labeled on this slide. Okay. But what's the building block for a muscle fiber? Our myofibrils. What's the building block for a fascicle? Will be muscle fibers, right? And if we put a bunch of fascicles together, what do we get? We get a muscle. Yeah, we get a whole muscle, like a biceps or triceps or something like that. Okay. Each of these things have their own connective tissue sheath, like around the whole muscle is the epimysium. And around every fascicle, okay, is the perimysium. And around every muscle cell is the endomysium. So endo is the deepest part, right? And the perimysium surrounds the fascicle. And on top of all that, you have the epimysium, right? Epi, peri, endo, mesium. And these are just connective tissue sheaths that surround these different building blocks of muscle. Right, well, I can see that the epimysium on this cross-section that we're looking at is located really at a far distance compared to where the perimysium is. Right, so you have all these fascicles in between these two. But as we move to one end of the muscle or the other, the perimysium fuses with the epimysium. Can you see all these things coming together at one end? Right, and so that's connective tissue. And even the endomysium fuses with the perimysium. Then that fuses with the epimysium. So all of these connective tissue sheaths right, joined together so that if one muscle fiber contracts, right, that whole muscle contracts because all these connective tissue layers are added together. Okay, so what's the building block of a fascicle? A fiber, yeah, and another name for fiber is a muscle cell. And what's the building block of a whole muscle? Fascicles, right, okay. All right, so we're halfway done understanding some of the organization because here I see structure inside of a muscle fiber, and we want to know what some of these things are called. Okay, and we're going to get to that really soon, but I'll introduce it to you right now. So here I see a muscle fiber, just a very short segment of it. All right, so here is, okay, what do we call that connective tissue sheath that surrounds the whole muscle fiber? You know what, I don't see it on this slide. Okay, I just see the cell membrane. All right, but around the cell membrane would be endomysium. Endomysium would be nice to draw on top of this. All right, here's the cell membrane for that cell. Here are all of the structures that we see inside the muscle cell. And I said these things are called myofibrils. Right, these are the organelles for contraction. You see some repeated pattern in this myofibril, and you know what that's called. Those are called, okay, striations, right? So you can see all these stripes on the outside of this muscle fiber, right? And when you look inside of a myofibril, right, is it all the same color, or do you see even more structure inside a myofibril? You might have to look really close. Maybe on the next slide, what do I see? Ah, here is the end of a myofibril. Do you see structure in there? Indeed. You're going to have to know something about the structure here as well. I see some dots in this nice transverse section. I see some large dots and some small dots. What the large dots represent are proteins, right, that move along the long axis of this myofibril. And this is a thick fiber. These other ones are much smaller. We're going to call these thin fibers, thick and thin. Thick and thin have a couple different names as well. The thick ones are what we call myosin, and the thin filaments are what we call actin. All right, so now we can actually build a whole muscle. All right, the actin and myosin are what we call myofilaments. So if you want to build a myofibril, which is the organelle for contraction, what are the building blocks of a myofibril? Myofilaments. And you could give me two examples of myofilaments, actin and myosin, or myosin and actin. Right? You just got to know that myosin is the thick filament, actin is the thin filament. And if we put a whole bunch of myofibrils together, what do we get? We get a muscle fiber. If we put a whole bunch of muscle fibers together, what do we get? I don't want to flip back. You get a fascicle. If we put a whole bunch of fascicles together, we get a muscle. All right, so it's nice to move up and down that hierarchical organization of a muscle. All right. Should we go the other way just for fun? Yeah, okay. So we have a muscle. We got a whole big muscle. For instance, like a biceps. What's the building block of a whole big muscle? It's fascicles. Yep, fascicles. And what's the building block of a fascicle? Is a muscle fiber. What's another name for muscle fiber? Muscle cell. Okay. And to build a muscle cell, what do we need? The building block of a muscle fiber or cell is a myofibril. All right. And then a myofibril has pieces that make it up. What's the general name for the pieces that make up a myofibril? They're called myofilaments. Okay, myofilaments. Is that on any of these slides? Myofilaments. Oh, I see filaments. But myofilaments. And then furthermore, you should know two kinds of filaments. Myosin and actin, thick and thin filaments. All right, so that's going from gross anatomy to submicroscopic anatomy. You can't see these filaments on with just a light microscope. All right, so where I have the cursor right now, what kind of filament do I have the cursor on right now? Moving it around so that you can see it. Okay, that is the thick filament. And where I have the cursor right now is the thin filament. And can you tell the thickness is different? Yeah, it's easy to see, right? And the thin is always going to be actin. The thick is going to be myosin. Okay, so that's some organization. All right, now muscle, remember, it's specialized to contract. We're going to learn something about the machinery that allows it to contract. Muscles usually have two ends. And if it's skeletal muscle, what are those ends connected to? Skeleton, right? And hence, that's why it's called skeletal muscle, because it's attached to your skeleton. And a skeletal muscle, or the two ends of a skeletal muscle, are never connected to the same bone. They're connected to different bones. And when that muscle contracts, it brings those bones together, and there's usually some kind of joint. Okay, so the ends of a muscle have different names, depending on what it's doing. So here is, this looks like a nice, almost looks like the biceps, but it's a little bit deeper. You're going to recognize this to be the brachialis. And there are two ends. Here's one that we call an origin. Here's one that we call the insertion. And when that brachialis contracts, right, it moves the forearm up like that. And that kind of motion, what do we call that kind of motion?
Flexion.
That's flexion. Yeah, flexion at the elbow, you could call that. Or flexion of the forearm, either one. Forearm flexion or flexion at the elbow, exactly the same kind of thing. All right, so when that muscle contracts, we name the end of the muscle that produces the least amount of motion the origin. All right, and the other end of the muscle that is producing the most motion is called the insertion. So those are two important places on a muscle, origin and insertion, and they're given that name depending on what their function is. Right? The more movable end, what do we call the more movable end of a muscle? Insertion, and the lesser movable end is the origin. A lot of muscles, the origin produces no motion whatsoever, but that's not a good way to think about it. It's the lesser motion compared to the other end. All right, so the insertion produces the most motion. Okay. And I can see some connective tissue between the brachialis, right, and its coronoid process right here, and that is a tendon. A muscle-to-bone connection is a tendon. Okay. What do I want to look at next? All right, well, let's look at some of the machinery that causes this muscle fiber to contract. Oh, one last thing I wanted to say about this muscle fiber. You see a nucleus inside this cell. Okay, what color is this? Here's the nucleus. What color is that?
Purple.
Okay, nice color. All right, now how many nuclei does a cell usually have? It usually has one. Now how many nuclei do you see in this muscle fiber? Okay, I see three right here. Right, and if we were to draw out the whole length of this muscle fiber, we would see many, many more. So here's a strange kind of cell. It is what we call multinucleated. It has many, many nuclei. And the reason for that is, well, this muscle fiber or skeletal muscle cell was many cells, contractile cells at one time, that were very short that fused together. And all of those nuclei from all the cells that fuse together still remain inside this really big, long fiber. So muscle fiber, right, during development comes about because many cells join together and all these nuclei stay in that muscle fiber. Okay, so it's a multinucleated cell. All right, striations. Right, are due to a repeated pattern over and over again within the myofibril and even neighboring myofibrils. All right, so I see thick filaments and thin filaments, and I see some other kind of lines like the zigzag line right here, right, and then I see a zigzag line over here, and if we were to draw this myofibril out from end to end, you would see that this is the repeating unit over and over and over again, right, that I see right here. Okay, so here would be one of those zigzag lines. Here's one, here's the next one, here's the next one, here's the next one. And all these myofibrils line up perfectly together. So it's very easy to observe these things. All right, so this structure between the zigzag line here and the zigzag line here is what we call a sarcomere. And a sarcomere is really important because it's the structural and functional unit of contraction. All right, what's the structural and functional unit of life? A cell, right? What's the structural and functional unit of compact bone called? Compact bone. Strong bone. Incompressible bone. It's called an osteon. Right? So if you know how an osteon is made in one bone, you know how it's made in all others. If you know how a sarcomere is put together in one myofibril, you know how all sarcomeres are put together, or how all myofibrils are put together, or how all muscles are put together, right? Because that's the basic building block of contraction, is a sarcomere. So we want to learn a lot about a sarcomere. And so there's an end point. The end points are these zigzag lines. We call that the Z-disc, right? And I don't think it's called a Z-disc because it has a zigzag appearance right here. Probably it's called a Z-disc because it's the last letter of the alphabet, which is what? The end of this structure that we were looking at. It's the tip. Okay? And attached to the Z-disc are some of the myofilaments. What kind of myofilaments do you see attached to the Z-disc? On either side, it doesn't matter. What do you see? I see actin, right? That's a myofilament. That's a thin one. All right? And then in the very center, right, there is what we call an M-line. That stands for, I guess, the midline of the sarcomere. And attached to that M-line are what kind of filaments? The myosin, right? So the myosin are attached in the middle. The actins are attached at the end. And, of course, the myosin, because they're thick, they block a lot of light when you shine light through them. And so that looks like a dark area underneath a microscope. And because the actin proteins are very thin, that allows for a lot of light to go through there. And so we call this the light band, right, or light area. So we have a dark band followed by a light band followed by a dark one over and over and over again in that repeating fashion. Okay, the dark band is what we're going to call the A band. Unfortunately, A and dark kind of match up really nicely because there's a nice A in dark. Right, so here's the A band. The light band, right, is what we're going to call the I band. Unfortunately, that I also is contained in the word light, so that's really easy to remember. That's not how they got named, but that's going to help us understand or remember what makes up a sarcomere. Something else about a sarcomere. We talked about some myofilaments, right? So here is a Z-disc. Here's a Z-disc. What do we have between the Z-discs? A sarcomere, right? A sarcomere. And on this diagram, probably I would like to have this solid arrow go all the way over to the end, right? Because here's a sarcomere from end to end. All right, and in the middle, you have the myosin filaments joining at the M line. And on the ends of the sarcomere, attached to the Z-discs, you have the actin proteins, right? And so when you try to shine light through the structure where you have overlap between actin and myosin, and because you have myosin, which is really thick, this is the darkest area within a sarcomere, right? And then in this area right here, we're going to call this the H-zone. It's right in the middle. It contains the M-line and some myosin. This area is sort of dark. Right, it's sort of dark because these myosin filaments are really thick, but it's only sort of dark because there's no actin in this region whatsoever. Right, so it's not as dark as this area right here. And then where you only have actin, right, that's what we call the I band. Right, you only have actin, and you have another protein that I want to mention. It doesn't aid in contraction. This is an elastic filament, right, called titin. All right, so what can you tell me about something that has elastic properties? Okay, can it contract? Okay, and I want to make a little bit of a distinction. It only changes shape when you stretch it. Okay, when you stretch it and let go, what happens? It goes back to its original length. Okay, if it's at its original length, it can't pull on either side. It can't get shorter. Okay, it only can go back to its original length after you stretch it out. All right, so this elastic or this titan filament right here is not important for forcefully contracting this sarcomere. It only aids in what? When the muscle relaxes, okay, it goes back to its natural length, or when this muscle is stretched. That's why it's there. The other thing that it does, it helps stabilize this myosin filament so that it stays in the middle of the sarcomere. That's really why it is there. All right, so that's pretty much everything about a sarcomere. Right, you got the filaments. The two most important filaments for contraction are myosin and actin. Right, and you should notice that every myosin filament is surrounded by what? You see it in two dimensions here. What's on top of this myosin? So here's myosin. What's on top of it? An actin. And what's below it? An actin. And on either side, which you can't see in front and in back, is going to be actin as well. So surrounding every myosin filament are actin filaments, completely surrounded. And as a matter of fact, if we look at this actin filament, what's on top? What's right above it? Here's actin. What's right above this actin filament? A myosin myofilament. And what's right below this actin myofilament? Myosin. And if we look in front and in back, you're going to find myosin as well. So these filaments surround each other. Everything surrounding a myosin myofilament is actin. Everything surrounding an actin is a myosin myofilament. So they surround each other. So there's going to be because of that special structure, there's going to be a special kind of association between these filaments, which we're going to talk about in just a second. Okay, so here is a nice electron micrograph of a sarcomere. What could you tell me about a sarcomere? What is it a building block of? It's a building block of contraction. Yeah, it's a structural and functional unit of contraction. And here are the endpoints of a sarcomere. What do we call the endpoints of a sarcomere? The Z-disc. So here's a Z-disc. Here's a Z-disc. Here is that A-band that's really dark because it has myosin myofilaments in it, right? We call that the A-band. Right smack in the middle, we have that M-line going down. I see a little dropout of signal on either side of the M-line because you no longer have any actin in this region. You only have myosin. And then way over at the end, I see the I-band. And what can you tell me about the I-band? Here's a better place to look at the I-band. It has some proteins, but what kind of proteins are here? Actually, think about myofilaments. What kind of myofilaments are right here? Only actin, which are thin, and that's why it shows up as a light band. So here is the sarcomere, thick filaments, thin filaments. Myosin is always right within the very center of that sarcomere. All right, so how does a sarcomere contract? What are the two main kinds of filaments that we have? We got actin and myosin. Let's see what kind of markers I have. So actin and myosin are long filaments. And let's pretend that I have those two filaments right here. I think this kind of works. They're both the same diameter, but pretend one is thinner than the other. And so here I have a red one, right? Do you see this myosin red on here? Okay, that's nice. Okay, so my red marker is going to be myosin. This black marker is going to be actin. Okay. And so my question is, when a sarcomere shortens, which one of these proteins shortens? Is it the actin or the myosin? Okay. Oh, but there could be another possibility. Maybe they both shorten. Right, so it could be one or the other or both. What would you think? Which one shortens when that sarcomere shortens? Which one contracts when the sarcomere contracts? Okay. Some people say actin. I kind of like that. Some people say myosin. I kind of like that. But it was a really nasty trick question because the correct answer is neither of them shorten. So how is it, okay, that the Z-disc can get closer together if neither the actin or myosin shorten? Okay? Now, can my markers shorten? They cannot. So that's a pretty good model for actin and myosin inside a sarcomere. All right, so we said, here's the actin. Actin is going to be attached to the Z-disc. So here's a Z-disc here. Myosin is going to be attached to the M-line. All right, so here, now the sarcomere is at rest. How can I bring my hands together without changing the length of actin or myosin? Look at that. What's happening? They're just sliding over each other. All right, so the myofilaments don't shorten. They do what? They slide over each other. We call that the sliding filament mechanism or theory for muscle contraction. So neither actin or myosin shorten. They just slide over the top of each other. Sliding filament mechanism. Okay, I've got some nice videos in Blackboard. Maybe I'll try and pull them up next time in lecture. Okay, I don't have them loaded up right at the moment. All right, so I'm going to turn the lights back off. So the nasty trick question was, which one of the myofilaments shorten? None of them. They just slide over each other. Bless you. So next time I'm going to show you how that happens. Here are some processes sticking off of the myosin molecule, and they can actually attach themselves to an actin molecule, and they can undergo a conformation change, almost like flexion. And when that happens, it's going to pull this actin filament over the surface of the myosin filament, and it's going to bring the Z disc closer to the M line. So these things are what we call cross bridges, and when that sarcomere shortens, there is what we call cross bridge cycling. Some of these cross bridges are formed and pull while others are relaxed, and when the ones that were pulling relax and the others attach themselves and start to pull. And another way you could think of this is, if there's a rope hanging from the ceiling, how would you get yourself up the rope? You'd grab with one hand, right, and pull up, and then what has to happen? You got to let go, reach forward again, and pull up. Right? That's exactly what's happening between actin and myosin. These cross bridges will grab hold, right, and pull, then release, extend up and grab once again, and then pull. And so that's what we call cross bridge cycling. So there's a special function that's happening between the myosin molecule and this actin molecule. Where's the clock? Maybe I can get into Blackboard pretty quick and show you after we talk about a couple other things. Okay. All right, well, let's look a little bit more inside a muscle fiber. So here's a fiber, right? And the cell membrane for a muscle fiber is what we call the sarcolemma. And inside the muscle fiber, we have all these myofibrils. And you can see this repeating pattern. What is this repeating pattern called once again? Okay, and striations are made from, what's that building block? The structural and functional unit of contraction is the sarcomere. All right, so I see a sarcomere right here because I see a Z-disc, right? Here's a Z-disc. That's the end of a sarcomere. Do you see thin filaments? Do you see thin filaments in there? Yeah, up against the Z. Do you see the thick filaments attached to this M-line? Okay, now, what controls the sliding of these filaments over each other, right? Because you have voluntary control of that, right? You can cause those filaments to slide over each other or not, right? So we're really interested in that process of how that happens, right? And if we're going to understand that process, we got to know a little bit more about the structure, what that surrounds, right, these myofibrils inside the cell. Well, that process requires energy. So inside the cell, we're only looking at a piece of it over here. Do you see any kind of structure or molecule or organelle that can provide energy to this sarcomere? You see mitochondria, really nice. You see a lot of mitochondria in skeletal muscle. And what's the job of mitochondria once again? To make ATP. So ATP is necessary for cross-bridge cycling, for these filaments to slide over each other. Okay, what else do I see? I see some endoplasmic reticulum that surrounds the myofibril. And does that look like smooth endoplasmic reticulum or rough endoplasmic reticulum? Yeah, it looks smooth. So would you say that this endoplasmic reticulum is important for protein synthesis?
No.
No. Okay, so what did we say function of smooth ER is for? Okay, it's for making lipids. And one other thing, it's a little bit obscure. Your book doesn't make a big deal of it, but you'll see why it's a big deal. It stores something. What does it store? Calcium, it stores calcium, right? Calcium ions. That's its job right here. Okay, and so I see a network right along the M line, but I also see some enlarged areas of that endoplasmic reticulum on either end of the sarcomere. These are what we call the terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so sarcoplasmic reticulum is endoplasmic reticulum, except it's in a skeletal muscle cell. Right, smooth endoplasmic reticulum and sarcoplasmic reticulum are the same thing inside of a muscle cell. That's a little bit worried. Okay, so here's the terminal cisternae. It butts up against this special tube. I'm going to talk about this special tube in just a second. And then on the other side of this special tube, you have some more sarcoplasmic reticulum, like a terminal cisternae of one in a neighboring sarcomere. So these three structures together, right, the two terminal cisternae and this tubule right here, is called a triad. Okay, so why is this special tube right here? Well, a lot of ways to think of a muscle is that it works like a nerve cell. All right, so we haven't talked about nerves just yet, necessarily, but maybe you have an idea. What does a nerve cell do? What does a nerve cell do? A neuron. It sends electrical signals very rapidly from one location in your body to the other. Okay? That's it. It's specialized. Now, does a nerve cell contract? No. Muscle cells contract. But muscle cells have something in common with nerve cells. It can send electrical impulses over the surface of the cell of a muscle cell, right? Just like a neuron can do, right? But that electrical signal is trapped on the outside of the cell, on the plasma membrane or the sarcolemma, right? But that electrical signal has to signal all of these myofibrils, even though they're deep inside the cell. So how does a muscle cell get that electrical signal deep? All right, so here is the cell membrane. That electrical signal will come down the cell membrane. It will get to this tube, and it will jump into this tube and travel all the way deep inside the muscle fiber. All right, and so this is what we call a transverse tubule. It's an extension of the cell membrane that surrounds all of the microfibrils, or the myofibrils. And that is just a way for an electrical signal to get from the cell membrane deep inside the muscle fiber. Okay. And when that electrical signal moves down through a T-tubule, it causes release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and that calcium is what causes the myofilaments to slide over each other. Okay, so what other function do you know that's important for calcium? Why would you want to have calcium in your body? For bone, to make bone strong. Absolutely. All right. But for muscle contraction, okay, what else do you need calcium for that? Yeah, okay, we just mentioned that. So you need calcium, you see, for two reasons. One, to make bone strong, and the other is for muscle contraction. All right. So muscle contraction and strong bones, you need calcium ions for. As we get older, right, our body starts to run out of calcium, and it has to pick. Where should this calcium go that's left in your body? So I'll give you the choice. Right, if you only have so much calcium, where would you put it? In your bones to make bone strong, or in muscle so that muscle contracts? Muscle so muscle contracts, right? Because your diaphragm is muscle. You can't breathe without muscle contraction. You wouldn't be able to move anywhere without muscle contraction. And you know what? Your body makes that same decision. So guess who loses calcium? Bones lose calcium to preserve muscle function and some other functions that we're going to see later on. All right, so that doesn't sound like a very good deal, right? You wouldn't like to lose, you'd like to keep both. Well, you sort of can keep both as long as you do what to bones? Exercise those bones, make them big and strong. But in order to make them big and strong with a lot of calcium, your body can't make calcium. You need calcium in your diet. And when you have calcium in your diet, it still doesn't enter your body unless you have vitamin D, right? So you need vitamin D, proper diet, and exercise to maintain bones, to make sure you have enough calcium as we get older in life. Okay. So here, this is an important exam figure. So what do we want to know? Sarcolemma, sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, you got all these myofibrils, mitochondria, myofilaments inside the myofibril, right? And the surface of a muscle cell acts a lot like a neuron. It sends electrical impulses. And how do those electrical impulses get down and stimulate all of the myofibrils, even though they're really far away from the cell membrane? How do they, it just hops down through this T-tubule, and then it excites, it tells the sarcoplasmic reticulum to release calcium, and then the filaments will slide over each other. So this is a pretty good, this is a good exam figure for you to know, because you see the sarcomere, and you see all these other pieces that cause contraction of that muscle cell. Okay. When calcium is present inside of a myofibril, that's what allows this myosin crossbridge to grab onto an actin molecule. Without calcium, right, these two molecules, actin and myosin, can't attach to each other. Right, and if they can't attach to each other, then the muscle can't shorten because actin and myosin can't slide. But as soon as calcium gets between the actin and myosin, or attaches in a special way to this actin molecule, this myosin head group can attach to it, right? And then it can flex, right? And it's going to pull the actin molecule over the surface of the myosin. All right, so that whole mechanism that I talked about, starting with the previous slide, this one right here, we call that excitation-contraction coupling. Right, so excitation is this electrical impulse traveling down the cell membrane, going into the T-tubule, causing release of calcium into the myofibril. That calcium is going to bind to myosin. When calcium binds to myosin, then myosin and actin can start to slide over each other. That's what we call this, the excitation-contraction coupling, all of those steps. Right, so one of the things that we talked about in muscle is that it is excitable, right, with that electrical event. Then it's converted into that chemical signal, calcium inside the myofibril, and as a result of that, then the muscle fiber will contract. Okay, so I have some things on this word slide, and there's some things I don't want you to know about. Okay, storage of calcium is good. This is all good. We're going to talk about the synapse neurotransmitter release next time. Where do I want you to stop? Okay. Right here. You don't need to know anything about troponin or tropomyosin. But in a physiology class, you'll learn something about troponin and tropomyosin. These are special components of an actin molecule that allow calcium to regulate whether that muscle cell is going to contract or not. Okay, but that's a little bit more detail than what we have in our book. You also don't have to know anything about depolarization other than it's an electrical event, right, that's responsible for something that looks like a nerve impulse on the surface of that muscle cell. Okay, so some of these things are important, but not toward the tail end over here. Okay, the sign-in sheet is going around. Next time I'll show you some videos of cross-bridge cycling and sliding of myofilaments, and then it will make a whole lot more sense.